Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to Sublimely Gothic, the podcast devoted only to the most sordid and macabre tales ever penned to paper. Here you shall explore the darkest jewels of literature with gothic enthusiasts Amy and Jess. Enter this realm at your own risk, for the night is dark and full of terrors. Welcome to the show, everyone. This is Season 3, Episode 1 of Sublimely Gothic. I'm Amy.
And I'm Jess.
And today we are kicking off the new season with a new entry into the Gothic canon, a YA horror novel by the name of Horrid. And joining us for that conversation is none other than the author herself, Katrina Leno. Thank you so much for joining us, Katrina.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
Yes, it's such an honor to have you, especially because your book marks the first time I bought a brand new release at full price in a very, very long time.
That's amazing. I'm honored. I hope the cover itself is worth the price because it's so beautiful. I'm very obsessed with it.
Yes, indeed. So is everyone else. Yes. So this episode will first contain an unspoiled interview of Katrina about Horrid, but after that we will delve into deeper themes of the books that shall require spoilers, and I of course will let you guys know when we hit spoilers. So, are you ready, Katrina?
I'm ready.
Of course, the big primary question that I'm sure you've answered multiple times in many capacities. What was the inspiration for the story, Horrid?
Well, I had just written a book called You Must Not Miss. And, you know, coming out of that book, I had used a nursery rhyme as a framing device. And I really liked it. I found it really inspiring. It was a nursery rhyme called You Must Not Miss, coincidentally. And I was kind of thinking about, you know, what do I want to write for my next book? I didn't really have any ideas. And so for a couple of days, I remember, you know, just going on a few walks and thinking about nursery rhymes in general. And I was like, that might be cool if I stick with that theme for another book and just see what happens. And so I was doing a lot of research into nursery rhymes, which of course, I mean, most nursery rhymes that we hear today are very, very dark and have very dark origins. And I mean, I think like the most famous example would be Ring Around the Rosie, which is about the Black Plague. And
oh, yeah.
And it, you know, it's kind of fascinating when you think about that we're like, you know, teaching these rhymes to our children, and they're all about death and, you know, evil things. And so I remembered my own mom used to recite this poem to me because I had curly hair as a kid, and I always had, you know, like one piece of hair that was curly in the middle of my forehead. And of course the poem is about a girl with a curl in the middle of her forehead. And so that was really where the jumping off point was for me. I, you know, there's the poem is in the beginning of the book. It's by Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, and it is about a girl who is very good until she's not good, and then they say she's horrid. And so that's kind of where the inspiration and the title came from. That nursery rhyme.
Indeed. And I think that's one of the most compelling things of why I enjoy this book so much, because I am a big fan of poetry. I've self-published a couple of poetry collections, and I have a whole podcast devoted to insta poetry. And so, yeah, the fact that it's such a thematic, everything is wrapped around this poem really got to me, and I'm going to read the poem. There was who had a little curl right in the middle of her forehead. And when she was good, she was very, very good. But when she was bad, she was horrid.
So creepy.
Yes, and I really like it because, again, if you want, we want to go real deep, it's about the duality of mankind, that, you know, we both have good and evil within us, and if we are provoked, we can all turn horrid.
Yeah, definitely. I like that. And the actual poem is so the nursery rhyme is kind of adapted from the poem, but if you look up the whole poem online, it's a little bit longer. And I'm going to save this for the spoiler section. So remind me later to come back to the longer part of the poem and how it further inspired Horrid.
Okay, wonderful. So Jess, did you have any questions that you wanted to ask Katrina, or do you want me to just go off of mine?
Well, I'll ask one since we're in the beginnings of the book. And then, Amy, I'm just so afraid at this point that I'm going to ask something spoilery, and this book is too good to spoil. So if I may, the first sentence, which thought I had my place back to get to it, I just want to read it because this is what sold me. And to the point, I called my my friend who's an author as well. And he's been on the show as well. His name is Morgan. And I said, Morgan, this is the best first sentence I have read in a book. She couldn't remember the first book she had eaten. That just made me go, what am I about to read? So I also remember in writing exercises being told, like, you need to get that first sentence. That hook needs to be there. Because if you don't capture your audience right away with that first sentence, it's just, you're just trying to lure them in. So I was hooked. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, totally. I'm glad you called it out because it was a struggle with this book to get the first line right. And it didn't come in the first draft, which is kind of rare for me. Like usually my first lines are pretty solid and they get me into the draft. And then, you know, obviously a bunch of stuff changes in the editing process, but usually that first line doesn't. And for Horrid, I just knew that I kept not getting it. I can't remember exactly where the first draft started, but I think it dropped you in while her and her mom, you know, so the book starts off and Jane and her mother, Ruth, are driving across the country, moving from Los Angeles to Maine and this little town in Maine. And I think the first draft of the book kind of dropped you into their car ride as they're like almost arriving at this town called Bell's Hollow. And I just knew going into the second and the third drafts that it wasn't good enough. And I was really struggling. I rewrote the first chapter many, many times. And finally, I thought to myself, you know, the first line needs to be creepy. Like, you need to know, you know, set the tone for the book immediately. It needs to be creepy. And it also, I think, needs to speak to the fact that Jane is a little bit off. Like, something is not quite right with her. There's a deeper, you know, sort of darkness going on. And so the whole subplot of her eating books and like having eaten books since she was a young child and this compulsion, which in the medical community is called pica or pica. I'm not quite sure how to pronounce it. It's spelled P-I-C-A. I ended up doing a lot of research into that and I found that really fascinating. And I did, you know, even more research into people who do feel a compulsion to eat paper. And I was kind of surprised to find that there's a lot of pica compulsions that aren't dangerous. And paper is generally one of them. Like if you eat a page a day, there's not really any side effects that you're going to be experiencing with that. And so I thought, like, what a perfect kind of creepy, kind of mysterious trait that Jane has. She eats books. And so that's how I arrived at that first line, which I, you know, ended up being something that I'm really happy with in the book.
I absolutely love it. I think it says so much. And you're right. It captures all those things that you mentioned, kind of like, you know, something's off and it's very creepy. So again, I really, really loved that. That was a hook right away.
And I really enjoyed it because I didn't fully get it. I thought it was still trying to be like a poetic, like, oh, I devoured the book. Like it took me a while to get that. Oh, she means this literally, doesn't she?
Yeah. I mean, I think that that's one of the ways that, part of, you know, you mentioned the duality of the poem. And I think that there's a duality of this trait because it's kind of a common thing to say, like, I love this so much, I could just eat it. Or you're looking at like a newborn baby, like, oh, I could just eat you up. And so there is that part of it that is hyperbolic, but it turns out in this case that it's not hyperbolic. She's literally eating the books.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I can't take credit for this. Jess was just telling me about this. So I have, as I mentioned before, I have a 7-month-old kitten. And his official name is Sir Francis Bacon. But we call him Mr. Bacon. But as Jess found out, there is a quote from Sir Francis Bacon about books that's quite relevant, and let me read it. Some books should be tasted, some devoured, but only a few should be chewed and digested thoroughly.
Oh, wow. I've never heard that. I love that.
Indeed. So thank you for that little tidbit, Jess. So fascinating.
I have no idea. I don't know what prompted it. It came across my screen. And since Amy has a cat named Francis Bacon, I know nothing about philosophy and things like that. But Amy is very astute in those things. And I was like, oh my gosh, this is the perfect quote for our conversation tonight. So I had to.
Yeah, it really is the perfect quote. I love that.
Yeah. Here's what's another question I have. So do you consider yourself a fan of Gothic literature? If so, what are your favorites? And were there any that came to mind while you were writing Horrid?
So I consider myself a fan of horror in general, but not really Gothic horror in literature. I would say that when I was writing Horrid, I took a lot of inspiration from, I think, that Daniel Radcliffe movie. What was that called? The Woman in Black?
Oh, yeah. We've covered The Woman in Black on this show.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that whole, I haven't seen that movie, and I purposefully try not to like watch or ingest things that may directly like influence the work I'm working on at that moment. So I purposely didn't watch that movie while I was writing this, but I had seen it like 10 years ago or whenever it was that it first just came out. So it was kind of in my consciousness as that's like the house I want, you know, the house in Horrid is called North Manor. I want North Manor to be that creepy. And I had read We Have Always Lived in the Castle probably like 5 or 6 years ago. And I love that book. And so that was another one where it was in my mind as I wanted that to kind of be inspiration. But again, I purposefully didn't reread it until after I had finished Horrid. And then the books that I was really reading a lot, and this is because, of course, Jane, the main character, has a very big Agatha Christie obsession. So mm-hmm. I read a lot of Agatha Christie novels as I was working on Horrid, because I wasn't really worried that they would influence the writing, because the writing style is very different. But I was just interested in how, I mean, Agatha Christie is a genius at like weaving in humor at the exact right moments to cut the tension and revealing, you know, the whodunit at the exact right moment and throwing in all these red herrings. And so since I've written Horrid, I've read The Haunting of Hill House, which has become one of my favorite books, I think, in the world. And so I'm like getting more into the Gothic literature because of Horrid, I think.
Interesting. Again, Jess and I were just talking about this a day or so ago. I love We Have Always Lived in the Castle. Not the biggest fan of Hill House, but Jess loves it.
I love Shirley Jackson's short stories. I don't know if I've read a lot of her stuff. I was just telling Amy, I don't remember what I've read and what I haven't anymore. But I really like, you know, I love The Lottery. She has a lot of short stories that I feel like are really really great. And I have written a lot about Shirley Jackson's short story.
Yeah, she has some incredible, incredible short stories. I don't know. I feel like The Haunting of Hill House is, you know, again, I did not read it for the first time until after Horrid was published, actually. But I found it to be the whole journey that the main character goes through felt like sort of eerily similar to me. And so I think I really related to it and just read it like exactly when I was supposed to.
Cool.
Wonderful. So you'll be eager to talk about this. Tell us about the process for coming up for the cover, because that was one thing people were raving about while this book was being released. And definitely not only did it pull specifically me in, because as much as I, you know, like Gothic literature and stuff and was looking for a brand new release, the fact that it was such a pretty cover and not so grotesque, again, I tend to be much more on the Gothic side than the horror side, not that those aren't mutually exclusive by any means, but the fact that the cover was so elegant, I think very much compelled me that if there's a YA horror novel that I'm going to enjoy that's going to have like true Gothic tenets, it's going to be this one. So tell us the story of the cover.
So the cover is my favorite cover of any of my books. Horrid is my sixth book, and You Must Not Miss, which is the book that came out right before Horrid, now has a paperback version done by the same artist. So the artist's name is Tron Nguyen, and she I had never heard of her before, but the moment I got the comps, I kind of got them at the same time, I think around the same time, like the comp for the Horrid cover and then the comp for the You Must Not Miss paperback cover. And they really look like sisters, side by side. They just complement each other so well. The you know, You Must Not Miss is very sort of dark, and there's roses, and they have, you know, little red centers, but the roses are black, and there's all these vines. And then You Must Not Miss is brighter. It's like a blood red, and there's another girl on the cover, and instead of roses, it's all these magpies. And together, I just love them so much. But I just honestly can't take any credit for them, because you don't, in, you know, traditional publishing, you don't really have, you know, a say in the covers. I had, and I'm with Little Brown now, and that's where Horrid, you know, and You Must Not Miss came out. And Little Brown is incredible, because they actually sent me two artists, and I immediately was like, oh, we need to go with Tron. Her work is absolutely incredible. I mean, she's just one of the artists where everything she does, I'm completely blown away with. And so I had been able to pick her, and then she, you know, sent over the first drafts of these two covers, and nothing really changed. Like, they were perfect from the moment I saw them. So it's nice, because it's like a piece of the book that I get to just fully fangirl over without, like, it has nothing to do with me. It's just like an artist's interpretation of my work, which is, you know, mind-boggling to me, and also just so special for me. I love them so much, but I can't take any credit for them, but they're beautiful. I just, yeah, they're perfect for the books.
Yeah, and I remember that there was a special edition for all the people who ordered the book via the Owlcrate package, and that one was specifically The Roses Were Red.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I kept looking at them, and I'm just like, I like the black roses better, because that's more relevant to the plot.
I know, I like, they look so cool together. I mean, you know, so, the Owlcrate thing was huge for me, and something I'm really grateful for, and I was really excited to see what the special edition cover was going to be. And that, you know, that whole process, I have like even less of a say over, because, you know, that's like the Owlcrate and my publisher kind of working together. And the cover was so beautiful. They were, you know, quite literally like, we can't change it. We're just gonna, you know, change the color of the roses. And then they added a red sort of like shadow to the title, which I thought came out really well. But you know, I love them both together. I feel like I'm really excited that I got to see both versions.
So I had another question, but you basically kind of answered it because you talked about the title and the poem. So we'll skip that one. So your story is set in rural Maine in the town of Bell's Hollow. Why did you choose that as the setting for Horrid? Is that a fictional town, or was it?
Yeah, so it was a little bit of an homage to Stephen King, who is, you know, has been one of my, you know, biggest inspirations since I was very young. He was one of the first writers. Actually, he was probably the first writer that I really became aware of the fact that books were written by people. Like, I was reading him around the time that I was probably like 11, 12, and until then, you don't really think about where books come from, right? They're just like beautiful things you have in your room and someone reads them to you, or you read them yourself. But you don't think about the process of, oh, someone wrote this. And so Stephen King was really the first writer for me that I was like, oh, this is a person. Like, his books, the old hardcovers used to have like a massive photo of him on the back, right? It's kind of hard to ignore that this is like a person writing the book. And so he is, of course, lives in Bangor, Maine, I think. And all of his books are set in Maine pretty much. And so it was a little bit of an homage to him. And the town itself, the town of Bell's Hollow, is fictional. With the naming of it, I took a little bit of inspiration from Stars Hollow from the Gilmore Girls, which is a show that I both love and hate at the same time. Mostly love it. but the town, I like the town feeling a little bit small and sort of like everyone knows each other. Because I think, you know, no spoilers, one of the later plot points doesn't really work unless everyone knows each other, and like unless it's more of a small town vibe. So that is why I took that inspiration from Stars Hollow. And Yeah, and the town, I mean, there's a part early on when Jane and her mom Ruth, they go to a diner and they kind of describe the town square, and that's like very, very Gilmore Girls, like the town square and the gazebo and all that good stuff.
Oh, nice. Yeah, I love towns names that have hollow, because like Legend of Sleepy Hollow, that's my favorite ghost story, or Godric's Hollow in Harry Potter. Like, I just love the idea of hollow, like using the hollow of a tree as a metaphor for like a dwelling in a town.
Yeah, I mean, and it's also really creepy, right? It's just a creepy word. It's like a little spooky, and yeah, I like it too.
If I may, Amy,
Of course.
Katrina, what was the first Stephen King book you read, if you remember?
The Shining.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, I read The Shining when I was very young, probably again like 10, 11, 12. I had sort of an unlimited access to the library, meaning my parents just would not look at the books I was checking out. And as a result, I was like reading these incredibly scary stories at a really young age. And The Shining and The Stand actually is one of the only books to this day that I got halfway through, and it's a massive book. It's like 1200 pages, The Stand. I got halfway through it, and I remember so vividly sitting on my bed and like what my bedroom looked like and being like, 11, 12, and thinking to myself, oh, this is too scary for me, and I need to stop reading it. So I read, like 600 pages of that book and just put it away and never picked it up again. And I think there's something really cool about just being that scared of a book.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah, we intend to within season three to I know we had to go over at least one novel by Stephen King, and so we're gonna do Salem's Lot later.
Oh, awesome. Yeah, I mean,
Yeah.
he's the master,
Yeah, and we chose Salem's Lot because we're the sucker for vampires.
Absolutely.
Love that.
Anyway, I digress. So, what is the key theme and/or message in Horrid that you're trying to convey?
I think, in a lot of my books, there's a threat of mental illness and I've been struggling with depression and anxiety my whole life, and I was sort of I'm 36 now, and I was diagnosed, literally over 20 years ago. So it's something that when I was diagnosed, it wasn't talked about the way it is today. I feel like today it feels very normal to tell your friend like, oh, I have anxiety, I don't want to do that, or I'm feeling depressed, I don't want to go out. And back then, especially as like a young teenager, it felt very scary and like very alienating and something that no one else in the entire world was experiencing outside of myself, because I didn't know anyone who was, and you didn't talk about it with your friends. And so it felt like this big, enormous, like secret that I had. And so that has kind of been a thread in all of my works, I think, and something that I'll probably just never stop writing about, because it's so integral to who I am as a person, and what I think about and how I process things is like through this lens. And so definitely that, and also loss and grief and how those manifest in someone. Jane is, you find out in the first few pages, she's mourning the very abrupt loss of her father, Greer. And she's also mourning the loss of her hometown and her entire childhood, because very abruptly her father has died, and her mother and her, decide that due to financial reasons, they can't really stay in Los Angeles anymore. And so they move away. And so Jane has lost not only her father, but everything she's ever known is now gone, and she moves across the country to a completely new town. So that was really why, though, those are the themes I think that I went into it, as looking at those as threads that would pull me through the book.
Yeah, Jess and I are currently doing another podcast about Harry Potter. It's a reread, and we were talking about these sort of things like body shaming and mental illness. Like, none of these things were talked about in the 90s.
Yeah, and I think that when I when I was diagnosed with depression, I was probably like 12, 13. And so that would have been 1998, you know, and certainly, you know, certainly like we didn't tell anyone in my family. Like I remember being like, we will not discuss this with your grandma and we will not tell your aunt and we will not tell your cousins. And it wasn't like, it wasn't from a place of like, this is bad, this is shameful. It was like, it was kind of coming from the knowledge that no one would understand. Mm-hmm. And I think I was actually, blessed with parents who really did understand. And in their understanding, they were kind of like, it is necessary to maybe not tell people right away. And now, of course, I'm like very vocal about it. I talk about it all the time. You know, I'm like, hello, nice to meet you. I'm Katrina. I do have depression. Let me tell you my whole mental health history. But back then, it just like you didn't speak of it, you know.
Katrina, I have to step in because I'm about the same age, so I remember same situation. I don't think it was ever named for me. It was just more like, oh, you're sensitive, or oh, you're sad, you know, like oh, whatever. And I remember it being called like being so discouraged to really address anything because I lived around people that would say, oh, you know, you don't want to take happy pills and things like that. Yeah. So I'm really glad you mentioned that in relation to this book, because there is that kind of sense in Jane's character that does come through, that there is obviously she's just had a huge loss. That's not a spoiler. Mm-hmm. But that gives some great context for that character. So thank you for sharing that one.
Of course. I also got on antidepressants when I was around that age, which was 12, 13. And that was like another mm-hmm. thing I couldn't talk about, and also didn't want to, because the idea, it just felt very embarrassing and very scary. And so I don't know. I think I became a writer in part to talk about that with younger people. And if I can like be this sort of dawning moment in one person's head where they're like, oh, I am not alone. I am not a freak. I am not like something secretive, because those are all thoughts that I had when I was a very young teen. So
I think that's awesome.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you for also sharing your experience with me, Jess.
I'm the same way. I advocate therapy constantly. The people at my job, I'm like, take advantage of the EAP, talk to somebody, get help. Like just, you know, it's out there. These resources are out here. If anything, too, I want to be an advocate for people to, you know, not kind of suffer in silence or destigmatize. So yeah, I'm the same way. People are like, I'm like, my name is Jess and I go to therapy every Thursday and sometimes twice a week. So that's
great. Good. I'm glad that you feel that way.
Wonderful. So I had another question. So I just saw either today or yesterday that Horrid is being made into an audiobook, correct?
Yes, it is.
What are the challenges in producing an audiobook, or how much or how little are you involved in that? And how is just that whole process going?
It's a boring answer because I'm honestly not really involved in it at all. My last book, You Must Not Miss, was the first of my books to get an audiobook. I think I got like 2 or 3 emails about how do you pronounce your name? How do you pronounce this character's name? How do you pronounce this? And that was it. And so I expect, you know, and I don't have like any say over, you know, who's the narrator, anything like that. And I expect Horrid to be exactly the same. Audiobooks are really exciting for me, though, because it's kind of like the cover. It's no longer my thing anymore. It belongs to me and this person who's, you know, person or people, if there's multiple narrators, who are reading my words. So it just becomes very fun to see what they do with it and see how the whole thing develops. But I'm sure I will have absolutely no input other than like, here's how you say my name, and that's it.
Yeah. Were you happy with how your previous book's audiobook turned out?
Yeah, I really loved it. It was a trip listening to it. I mean, it's just like the coolest thing in the world to hear your entire book read. But I was very happy with it.
Yeah, wonderful. Yeah, I'm really starting to get into ebooks just on general principle that I'm reading more, you know, with the pandemic and reading being my primary hobby, but also in this very weird sense of, again, my cat is so clingy that sometimes I can't even hold a physical book in my hand. So I have to resort to audiobooks to just sit my phone, sit there and have to cradle my kitty.
I was getting really into audiobooks like last year when I was commuting to my day job every day. I'd be in the car for like an hour and 15 minutes, hour and a half. And then when the pandemic really hit last year, I just completely stopped listening to them. And so now I'm trying to listen to them on my runs, which, you know, I only run for like a half an hour or whatever. And so it's been kind of a challenge, but it's been really fun because I'm listening to like a scary book on my run. And I feel like it's very motivating to keep going.
That sounds like, yes, I was going to say, I might have to try that. That would definitely.
Yeah, it's really fun. And you can sort of pretend that someone is like following you and telling you a spooky story. I highly recommend it.
So another question I had, what were the key challenges you faced when writing Horrid? Were they different than some of the other books you have written in the past? And I know you did touch upon the fact that it took a really long time to really hone in on what the killer first line, first sentence would be. Mm-hmm. Were there any others?
Yeah, I think that the challenge with Horrid, it's the tropiest book I've ever written. And by that, I mean like the haunted house is like one of the, you know, ultimate tropes in literature. I think there have been thousands of books written by haunted houses. The Haunting of Hill House being, you know, one of the best, The Shining being one of the best. And so I really struggled with what is going to make, like, what is the point of my book? What is the point of writing yet another haunted house book? And I'd always wanted to write a spooky book about a haunted house and a spooky house and like, you know, cobwebs and sheets over the furniture. There's something really appealing to that. So that I think was the hardest thing for me to figure out is like, what is different about my book? What's the different angle? And I think that's where mental health and comes into it, because you start to question a little bit what is happening versus what does this character think is happening and what is she sort of imagining? And yeah, that's the kind of the way that I got around it is really, really making it as character based as I can. And instead of letting the haunted house itself be the main character, you know, which I think works really well and can work really well. But instead of doing that, I just really tried as much as possible to keep the focus on Jane and to keep the focus on her mom and to keep the focus on like their journey. And so that was sort of how I approached that.
Yeah, no. And I think I remember discussing that in my BookTube review of Horrid and talking about like it's super tropey, all the gothic tropes, but they were executed so well that I love them.
Oh, thank you. That makes me feel very relieved. I mean, it's hard, you know, when you're writing about, you know, a bump in the middle of the night. I mean, how many times has another author written about a bump in the night? And so it all boils down to like, what is unique about your bump in the night?
Yeah, well, and again, Jess and I are the type where I'm reading like 5 haunted house novels in a month, and still yours was excellent.
Thank you. That's very sweet.
So what was the highlight of writing Horrid?
I think I really enjoyed, you know, no spoilers, how the ending came together. And so maybe this is a question best saved for like our past spoiler point, but I mean, often when I go into a book, I don't exactly know what the ending is going to look like. I don't really plot my books. I don't have any sort of outline or timeline or anything. And, you know, I knew the general idea where Horrid was going, but getting there and writing those, you know, the last like final scenes, they were really, really satisfying for me. So, and that is all I can say without spoilers.
We'll talk about the ending, please. Yes, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Did you have any other questions, Jess? Again, that can be before spoilers.
You know, I have one question that I'm dying to ask, but I'm really, oh, you know what? We talked about roses. So we can talk about the roses in the story. So you mentioned Gilmore Girls, one of my favorite book. Like, I don't know if it's going to be a trilogy or what, but it turns over to one of my favorite movies is Practical Magic. So I don't know, that scene with the mom, Jane, no, not Jane, is sorry, Ruth Ellen, going and cutting down the rose bushes just gave me a little bit of a like, oh, practical magic. Is there any reason roses specifically? And is there any nod to practical magic?
Yeah, it's a direct nod to practical magic. So you definitely hit the nail on the head. Practical magic is probably my favorite piece of literature / film in the entire world. I've watched it a billion times. I've read the book a billion times. And I mean, they're quite different, actually, the book and the movie. But the movie in particular, Sandra cutting down the rose bushes, just a pivotal moment in my own life. And yeah, that scene is stunning. And yeah. That's all I can say.
That just like won me over that much more because I watch Practical Magic at least once a year. I love the book. It just, I don't know. There's something about that. And the next book, The Rules of Magic, broke my heart in all kinds of ways. But yeah, that
I actually like The Rules of Magic better than Practical Magic, I think. Too. As far as like book to book, I thought it was really beautiful.
It is the time period. I love that time period.
Yeah.
In the 60s and just imagining the ants and, Oh gosh, that makes me happy. Okay. I was like, am I the only one who's just like obsessed with practical magic? And that's all I can think about right now. So I love to know that that's a nod to that.
No, it is. And, I think like going deeper, I find roses very creepy. I don't find them romantic. I don't think they're a pretty flower. If someone got me a bouquet of roses, I would be like, you are not paying attention. And so I think it's just like, I think it's like very satisfying for me just to make them as creepy as possible. And, over the course of the book, they only get creepier. And, the scene that you're referring to happens fairly early on in the book. And it only goes downhill from there. Roses are creepy.
Especially your roses. Yeah. So my last pre-spoiler question is, do you think there is a sequel in Horrid's future? Because again, my BookTube review of Horrid, that is the most popular video I've made with the most engagement, and people are constantly asking themselves, like, given the nature of the ending, will there be a sequel? So do you have any answers to that?
Amazing. I do. I mean, it's not an optimistic answer. At this point, I don't think I would write a sequel to Horrid. I obviously, like, people ask me a lot of questions. Actually, my sister-in-law just read it 2 days ago, and she was like, rapid fire, what happens here? What does this mean? What happens to this person? What happens to this person? And I was like, I'm not answering any of these questions because I know my answer, but I really strongly believe that the reader is just as right as the writer. And I can't really give specifics in the pre-spoiler, but if you are wondering what happened to a specific character and you feel like you know the answer, then you're right, And if I, as the writer, have an answer as to what I think happens to that specific character, I don't think that makes me more right than you because it's a duet, It's not just me writing the book and boringly like handing you all the answers. It's the reader interpreting everything too. So that was a long-winded answer to basically just be like, at this point, I don't think I would write a sequel. That could always change, but to me, the resolution feels very strong with Jane's journey. And that's always sort of like how I think about sequels, like, is there more to her story? And to me, at this point, I'm kind of like, no, that's the sort of the end.
Yeah, no, I can totally get that. And that's definitely how I felt about it when I read it. But again, I just think a lot of people, at least commenting on my review, was maybe they're not as entrenched in gothic stuff as I am. So they're not coming from it being very used to these sort of mysterious, ambiguous endings.
Yeah, so. I mean, the ending is like a very much love it or hate it. And I know we'll talk about it more past the spoiler mark, but and I think you're right. Like, people who don't have maybe a lot of background reading horror and gothic horror don't realize that it's like a it's like a pretty average sort of ending.
Maybe, yeah, that's a very it's a trope in of itself.
Yeah.
Alrighty then. Well, those are all the pre-spoiler questions. Thank you so much, Katrina, for indulging us.
Of course.
Yes, and now we'll move on to our spoilers portion of the podcast, where we talk about various plot points. So if you don't want to be spoiled, you should stop listening right now. And so we will begin where Jess and I will do our traditional exercise on this podcast of our 30-second recap. Jess, do you want to go first or shall I?
Oh, I was going to say, Katrina, please don't judge me on this review. I read this book around my recap, because I read this book around October and I loved it. So I hope I get everything. I don't care, Amy. I can go. You can go.
Okay. So yeah, I'll time you in 3, 2, 1, go.
All right. So we meet Jane and her mom, who are leaving the West Coast headed to Maine. And on the way, they stop at a bookstore. They get a warning from the bookstore attendant. They drive to North Manor, where the house is just creepy right away. Then they order some food. They kind of ease themselves in. They go to this diner, and everybody kind of knows who the mom is, but they're not really saying anything. Jane gets a job. She works at a coffee shop. She makes a couple friends, but she also makes an enemy with this girl, and kind of not really sure why. There are noises, there are roses, there are spooky little girls. There is an ending that rocked my world. I know I have, it didn't meet the 60 seconds, but that is my best wrap.
And you're done.
Cool. Okay. I'm still thinking I can't spoil anything. So I'm sorry.
Okay. Let me count myself in 3, 2, 1, go. So, Jane's father has died. Typical goth trope. Someone dies and they move into the dilapidated manor. Weird stuff starts happening at the dilapidated manor. Rose petals are appearing in sleeping bags in places they shouldn't. The mom knows that the roses are trippy, tries to destroy them and prune them, but then they grow back, and they grow back black, and that's really trippy too. She meets some people at her high school, and this one Melanie character is a bitch, but we find out later she's a bitch because her older sister Anne knew Jimena Rose, who Jimena Rose is the ghost, supposedly the ghost haunting the manor, who is not Jane's aunt, as her mom led to believe, but her own very sister. But Jimena Rose, her ghost, is evil. Confrontation with between Melanie and Jane. Melanie gets buried in the garden. Jimena Rose seduces Jane to do evil, and she eats a rose. Jane eats a rose.
Good
job. Perfect.
Alrighty then. So again, the elements of the story. So, let's see. Did you have any specific points you wanted to discuss now that we are in spoiler mode, Jess?
First of all, there was some harmed cats, which is a little gothic-y, and it also always makes me sad. So, Katrina, do you have pets? Do you have cats, dogs, anything?
Yeah, I have one cat named Milo.
Okay. My heart always hurts whenever there's like a cat situation, but I was like, okay, this happens. Just, it's okay.
I mean, it's like, what is the absolute worst thing I can think of? Oh yes, animal cruelty and like baby cats being hurt.
Yeah, well, that really, I mean, I guess I feel like a bit of a cliche, but when that happened, like, that amped my hatred of Melanie up to like 1,000. Like, that was Jemima. That really bummed me out. But that's good. That's what it was supposed to do. And then the ending, I will be very honest, Katrina, I was reading this on the Kindle and I hit the next page and it was like the acknowledgments. And I was like, wait a minute. So it really threw me for a loop. I don't know, Amy, is there something?
Well, we can go right into the ending, because it is definitely very dramatic, where I adored the ending because I was really worried that Melanie would just be this two-dimensional cardboard cut, mean girl, and realizing that she did have a connection to the house, you know, because she, and then to have, you know, we had these two girls, you know, Jemina Rose and Annie, and they were, you know, set against each other. And I really like the moral ambiguity of who murdered who, because a lot of it's portrayed as Annie acting in self-defense because Jemina Rose was not just horrid physical, but also tried to kill her first. And so I really liked that portion. And so to now have the two other sisters of like the next, like, not generation, but like the sub-generation, the younger sisters now having this confrontation over the past, I thought that was absolutely brilliant. And again, just how you interpret the ending depends on whether you take the position that Jane is psychotic and all these are hallucinations, or whether there's an actual ghost. My interpretation is that Jemima Rose was an actual real ghost. So just the notion that I knew it was a YA horror novel, but as it being a YA novel, I was very surprised how dark, not so much being ambiguous, but just how darkly ambiguous, because of just realizing that Jane is like, screw this, my father was taken away from me, life sucks, life's a bitch, I'm gonna eat this rose and I'm gonna be evil like my ghost sister.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think like, you know, for people questioning the ending, and I get a lot of, you know, is Melanie dead? Is Ruth dead? Is Will dead? Like, are all these people dead? And I'm like, I feel like all the answers are really in the text. It's just like whether, first of all, whether you want to see them, and second of all, how you interpret them. Because I think things could really go either way. And I think you bring up a really important point, Amy, which is that we're talking about the actions of, I think, 6 or 8 year olds, maybe. I can't remember how old the ghosts were now. I think 8 year olds, right? So like you have this ghost who may or may not be real, and she's telling you her version of the story, but Annie cannot tell you her version of the story. And at the end of the day, they were both little girls. And so I think the moral ambiguity is important to really, like, you know, make you question, am I rooting for a ghost? Like, does Melanie deserve being buried alive in a pile of dirt? Which actually my editor at one point was like, is this realistic enough, you know, being buried alive in a pile of dirt? And I took this story directly from my mother, who, when my mother was growing up, a girl that she knew climbed into a dirt pile, like a dirt hole. They were digging something in her backyard, and accidentally, as she like climbed into this hole, she managed to like cover herself in dirt, and she died that way.
Oh my gosh.
Which is a terrible way to die. Yeah.
Yeah. It makes me think of, you're just kind of making me hyperventilate right now. That's how I felt at the end terrible. Of the book.
It's terrible, but I was very adamant about, like, no, this is realistic. This, you absolutely, and of course, there's a bit of supernatural at the end, so.
As you rightly said, you know, these children were, like, 6 to 8 years old, so even if it was premeditated, did they really have the maturity to understand the implications of, I murdered someone? Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that whole question of, you know, you get here on the news, like, I remember one of the news coming up on YouTube for me again, just a terrible thing of a 10-year-old killed a baby, a 6-month-old infant at the daycare. Her parents were running, and like you, and it's that question of like, did they know it was wrong, or do they think the baby is just sleeping? Like, can you truly prosecute to a certain extent? And, you know, my whole feeling with that is, of course, you know, dealing with very, very young, I'm like between 5 and 10 years old is very different from like the cusp of teenagers and whether you want to try them as adults. Mm-hmm. But I always thought that, you know, as much as I know legally we have to treat everyone equally, and so that when you're 18 years old, when you become adult, but I know personally that just people mature at very different rates. And so there'd be some people who'd be like, yeah, they're just immature and don't really understand the implications. And then there are others that I'd be like, no, they knew what they were doing. They're evil. They're going to get tried as an adult.
It's an interesting question of, I mean, I even remember the like Slender Man, you know, thing from
the Slender Man thing.
It's interesting. It's like, when does a child even know the implications of their actions? And and when can they even fully understand what life and death mean, you know? And it's certainly like when Jemima was 8 years old, I mean, even if she's out there, you know, killing baby kittens, does that mean she deserved to die?
Right.
Again, and you know, the way that you, I wouldn't say sympathize, but at the very least understand Jemima Rose, because the way she's describing everything, again, her, if she's real, her ghost self is trapped in the psychology of a child, where she's just seeing the world in a very black and white, you know, I was killed, therefore I deserve, and you're my sister, you're supposed to have my back no matter what, not wanting to take in any other nuances that Jane originally is trying to convey to her, until Jane is like, screw it, and eats the rose.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
I think that something it made me think about is that sometimes people just don't make the good choice. Like, I think that that's something that in a YA book, I feel like it's often kind of trying to promote, like, the main character is going to make a good choice, a redeeming choice at the end.
Yeah.
And that doesn't happen. This is a second YA book that I read recently that had a character like that. The Song of Songbirds and Snakes, the Hunger Games book.
Oh, the Ballad of Songbirds and Snakes. Yeah.
Yes. The main character in that, I think he was related to the snow character. I'm sorry. Again, too many characters in my head here, but I remember like his character being like, oh, you didn't do the right thing. And that's, nuanced aside, I was just very surprised. I was like, oh, Jane, what are you doing? So I had a little bit of a, like, I had to take a moment after I finished this book and go, that is not what I expected to happen. So I think that is something that it made me contemplate, that just with people in general, more over the story, that just how people can make bad decisions or in the moment decisions that have repercussions that resonate. I was thinking about her mom. I was like, oh my God, her poor mother has to deal with this all over.
And I think, like, you know, Amy mentioned how Jane's like kind of last monologue in the final paragraphs are like, nothing that's happened to me has been fair, and I've been doing like everything right, but still everything has gone wrong for me. And so if I'm doing everything right and everything is going wrong for me, like, why don't I do something wrong and see what happens? And
right,
I think that, you know, that's something that, you know, I agree in YA, like certainly in most of my books, you know, you have characters who are making the right decisions and they struggle, but, you know, they kind of come out on top, and they come out where they've learned something, and they've come out where they've grown as a person. But in Horrid and in You Must Not Miss, I kind of view them as like sister novels a little bit. At the end of the books, they're not doing the right thing. Like, they are doing the bad thing, which is, I think, interesting. So
let's see. One thing I really enjoyed about the connection between Jane, she eats books. Jemima Rose, she eats roses. But the mom, Ruth Helen, she also ate hair. So they all these women in this family had some form of pica or pica or whatever we call it.
Yeah, and that's actually also based on a story from my mom's childhood. I don't know why she had such a creepy childhood, but when she was in grade school, she had a classmate who had to have surgery to remove a mass of hair from her intestines because she ate her own hair.
And that's usually linked to an anxiety of some sort, usually, right? I don't know that much about it. I've heard stories. I've heard people doing that, but I don't know anything about it beyond that it's something that happens, and I believe it's usually related to like a way to self-soothe or something.
I just perceived it as it's a form of stress eating, just a very, you know, weird, it's not just purely food, but it is, again, stress. It is supposed to be soothing because, you know, because you betray it with Jane, like she will get near blackout angry. And the only way she calms down is by eating the book paper.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that stress, anxiety, depression, it's definitely almost a side effect. And it's a compulsion for sure. It's an obsession. And, you know, I was thinking, you know, what is the thread that connects all these three women who have all of this anger and all of this rage? And the thread for them is that they all eat things that they're not supposed to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And again, just going off that, it just made me think of Root's character more in depth, because her rage basically stems from the fact that she came from this more upper class, well-to-do family, and her mom had certain expectations for her and she couldn't fulfill them. And so she just constantly had this rage of that she was never good enough for her mom. And then when Jemina Rose was born, basically she was extra mad that her mom was basically just trying to do a redo with her granddaughter instead of trying to make anything right with her daughter.
Yeah, you can definitely see like the cycle of abuse that's playing out. And, you know, Amelia, who is Jane's grandmother, you don't know a lot about her, but you understand that she was, you know, probably abusive, certainly not the best mother, very concerned with image and status, and really stifled Ruth in her childhood. And then Ruth has Jemima when she's really young and doesn't really want a baby, right? Like, but isn't allowed to make that decision for herself in her own body. So now she's 16 and she has a baby, but Jemima is raised by Amelia in the same like very stifling environment again. And then I think Ruth makes a very valiant effort to break the cycle of abuse, and she moves to California and she marries, you know, Greer, and they raise Jane in the best way they know how. So I think it also is a little bit of a nature versus nurture question at the end. Like, why does Jane still feel this much anger? You know, but the nature is sort of obvious, but the nurture, I mean, you have Ruth, who has been lying to Jane her entire life, right? Her entire familial history is hidden from her. And I think that certainly, you know, leads to some not nice things happening later on.
Anything coming to mind, Jess? I don't want to dominate the conversation.
No, well, I don't want to either. I think we're all being very polite. I think that's sometimes I have the opposite problem in my day job. That's what I'll say. Like, usually everybody's talking over me. I really appreciated something that, you know, seems not well portrayed often, but anger in women. I think that that is something that only recently has been brought to light. I know Gillian Flynn wrote a really fantastic.
I knew you were going to go there, Jess.
I love Gillian Flynn so much. Kansas City native. Gotta shout her out whenever I can. But she wrote something really fantastic about anger in women in literature, and how, you know, it's either dismissed or just kind of, you know, portrayed as like, oh, that lady's just an angry old biddy or a bitch or something like that. Mm-hmm. I like the subtlety in the anger here. When I say subtlety, I guess what I really should say is like roiling. You know, it's there, and then it just comes out in this almost like in the blackout anger, and you're, you know, doing the self-soothing with the books or the hair or roses. I just wanted to compliment that being portrayed, and, you know, kind of being able to see that in a female character or female characters plural is always a little bit of a relief, because I think it also makes somebody go, oh, I have those feelings sometimes. I'm not alone. Maybe I'm not going to like bury somebody because of it, but, you know, that is a feeling that's okay for women to have.
Yeah. I mean, I think that I read this this book called, oh gosh, I can't remember what it's called. Oh, The Female of the Species. And it's a YA book that came out a couple years ago. And it was really the first book I had read in YA that had a female character who was so angry. It's a great book. I recommend it wholeheartedly. It really kind of opened my eyes up to this question of like, well, why don't we have books where more women are angry? I mean, like, I know that I was angry growing up, and, you know, you have to sort of get to this point in your life where you learn how to control your anger. And that's, you know, that's a big point of sort of contention between Jane and her father. He's kind of the force in her life who's like, you have to control your anger. You can't go around punching people. You can't like go around yelling at people. And so I do think it's really interesting and satisfying for me to write about women who don't have that under control yet, you know. And I've read, you know, of course, Sharp Objects, and I think like that's a great example of a book where the main character, I can't remember her name now, but she, you know, she's so unapologetic with her anger and her attitude and her, like, you know, she's just kind of mean. She's like not really nice. She doesn't apologize for it. Obviously, she's has some events in her life that has kind of made her that way. But I like the idea that females don't really have to be nice. And that's it, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Amen.
Yes. One thing I really liked is, I know how you're saying, like, how do I make the bumps in the night, like, really my own? And I think one thing that really, because of the subtlety of it, is, you know, the roses showing up in places that they shouldn't. Like, the first time with the rose petal being in the sleeping bag, and then the rose is growing back, and then hearing something, and then there's a rose on the front porch, and then the rose isn't in her hand anymore, and you know, looking in the mirror, it's in a different space. So yeah, definitely your bumps were very, very good.
Thank you. I just like the idea of taking something that isn't necessarily creepy. Like, it wouldn't be that creepy to find a rose petal in your sleeping bag, but making it creepy, I think that's like very fun for me.
Indeed. And I think it was definitely the part where Jane goes back in her room and then it's spelled in rose petals, like, do roses taste like books? Like, that was the scene, that was the apparition that made me think, okay, this is a real actual ghost. Like, not that I know anything about psychiatry or psychosis or anything like that, but I just felt like that's a very specific thing to imagine to be there if it's not. So that was the one thing that sold me that it was in the supernatural category.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I like to think that the ghost is real, so.
If I may talk about one of the elements that is not very gothic-y, but like kind of a little bit of light in the darkness. As a former barista, I really appreciated the level of attention given to the barista job in the bookstore. So props on that. And I really like Will. That's Susie's brother's name. Am I correct? That is Will.
Yeah, you're right.
I really like Jane and Will's relationship. I thought, you know, it didn't get too romantic. Mm-hmm. I don't remember the element of romance, to be quite honest. I felt like I was a person that had a lot of male friends and female friends, but I did have a lot of male friends and I have for a long time. So I really liked kind of a more platonic relationship there. And maybe eventually it was going to take that path, but I didn't get that vibe. I feel like in some stories, it's just like at the jump, you know, girl sees boy and then, you know, hard eyes all of a sudden. So those were my two bright spots in Horrid.
Yeah, I kind of just like wanted Jane to have a really like nice sort of solid friend in her life that like isn't really trying to keep any secrets from her. And but also it's a little, I want it to be a little sad at the end when you realize that like she's not gonna get that happy ending with Will. Mm-hmm. And probably there's a path for her to take. I mean, he knocks on the door, you know, she could have left with him and her night would have gone a lot differently.
Right.
But yeah. I agree with you. I just think it's like more interesting when the love interest is like not very obvious. I think we have plenty of books about love stories and they're all done just like much more skillfully than I would be able to. It's just not my forte. I'm much more interested in the like not quite a love connection, but almost, but could have been, but you know.
Right.
I like that more. Yeah.
Yeah. And I liked how, you know, even though there's the little bit of light with the, you know, barista and the like the sort of cafe bookshop, but you make it relevant because you go back to the illusion of, oh, we've got these new like lattes, lavender and rose. And she's like, no, I don't want the rose one.
Yeah.
Yeah. My editor was also like, why are you so obsessed with lattes? You talk about lattes a lot in this book.
Lattes are delicious.
I was like, they're really yummy.
Right.
Exactly.
In my childhood town, there was a local coffee shop called Roasties, and my favorite thing to get was a butterscotch latte.
Oh my god, that sounds delicious.
That sounds really good. I actually have there's a coffee shop near me called Flower Boy, and they have, very coincidentally, I don't know if I went there before Horrid or during or after, but very coincidentally, they have a rose latte and a lavender latte, and ooh, that's like kind of their two specialties, and they're both excellent. But someone asked me like, oh, I wonder what a rose latte would taste like, and I was like, oh, it's a real thing, like it's not unheard of to get, you know, a rose or lavender latte, and they're both yummy.
I love a lavender latte. I'll have to try a rose one sometime. I know a coffee shop that makes one by my parents, so I will try that in your honor.
Oh, nice. Yes, please do.
And then going back to books, I have not read a great deal of Agatha Christie, but I was an avid watcher of David Suchet's Poirot series, and so I'm very familiar with Poirot in via those adaptations, and so I really liked the idea, and again, with Will, like, being recommended by Jane, oh, you should read this one Poirot book, and the fact that you use the sort of sentiment of there's this secret that everyone knows, but no one talks about it, and Will kind of puts the two and two together and is like, do you know what happened at that manor?
Yeah, it's called like a secret de la Polichinelle or something. It's this French expression, which basically means a secret that everyone knows. And one of the most well-known examples would be like professional wrestling, how everyone knows that it's scripted and, you know, it's all fake, but we all pretend that it's not. And like reality shows are another example of that. You know, everyone pretends that the Kardashians or, you know, The Bachelor is like an unscripted show, but everyone knows it's not. Like, it's a scripted TV show, which is produced, you know, much the same as any other scripted TV show, but we pretend it's not. And there's sort of an enjoyment in the pretending, and there's an enjoyment in the like, we're all in on the secret. And that, you know, when I was reading Mrs. McGinty's Dead, which is an Agatha Christie book that is a Poirot mystery, it gets to the end and that's how she sets up the whole mystery. She's like, everyone knows, well, I won't spoil the Agatha Christie book, but I will spoil my book because we're in the spoiler section. But yeah, basically it's like everything hinges on the fact that everyone in this very small town knows what happens to Jane. So why would they ever talk about it, right? Like, it would just kind of be considered rude. Like, welcome to Bell's Hollow. Sorry, your sister died here, you know, however many years ago. It just like isn't something that anyone would do. So it worked really well for my purposes, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Just my last point that I wanted to go over is, you know, again, we went through the whole thing of the thing with Pica and Jane eating books. And one thing I really honed in on is like, okay, Jane loves books and has lots of books, but there are only a few specific books that we're told that she's eating of. And so I honed in on the exact books that the two books were shown that she eats, which is Peter Pan and Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. And I interpreted that as those being children's books. By her eating them, she is basically, you know, it's a symbolism for the loss of her innocence. So am I completely off the mark or?
No, I feel like that's great. I mean, I think that for people who grew up loving books, you know, certainly me, I would guess both of you, there's always a soft spot for the books that we read as children. And like, for me, it was definitely all the books I kind of mentioned in Horrid, you know, Narnia, absolutely, Alice in Wonderland, Peter Pan, like these books are sort of untouchable and classic. And I think that there's a lot of comfort to be found in them. So I definitely think that like Jane, you know, there's a scene in the book where she kind of tries to eat like a chemistry textbook, I think, and she puts it in her mouth and she's like, this is disgusting. And I think that like, you know, points to the fact that it isn't just about the act of paper for her. It has to have that sentimentality too, and it has to have that connection. And so I think your interpretation is perfect, and I would just add that it has to be a book that makes her feel safe.
It's the nostalgic comfort of childhood.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, interesting. Any other thoughts, Jess?
The only other thing I wanted to mention is I appreciated Jane and her mother's relationship, the portrayal of that relationship. I thought, you know, I think sometimes, at least books I used to read, there was always this tension between, you know, child and parent. So it was really nice to read a relationship that was just kind of like a nice, friendly, or, you know, a good parental relationship. And I think it makes your heart break even more that Greer isn't there, because I'm sure he sounds like he was an awesome dad. And that relationship with the three of them would have just been great. And we do get glimpses of it. But I, again, wanted to say that I did appreciate that portrayal, as it seemed, it was refreshing to read that. And I feel like that is hopefully becoming a little more normal, to portray parent-child relationships that aren't a power struggle or abusive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thanks. I feel like, I think in all of my books, maybe not You Must Not Miss, but in most of my books, I really try and have healthy relationships between family, and whether that's a mom and a daughter or a mom and a dad or siblings. And it's important to me because I do feel like we've seen a lot of the dysfunction. And I think, you know, at the end of the day, most families work and people make mistakes, and certainly people are fallible, and certainly people have bad days. But I think there's something really beautiful about the everyday relationship that, you know, almost 18 year old girl would have with her mom, which I was very close with my mom when I was that age. And now, certainly. And so it's like more interesting for me to kind of explore that closeness than have the typical like teen movie, "I hate you, mom," you know? So that's like always just going to be more interesting to me, to show like the nuances of having a healthy relationship with your. And that's not to say that, you know, we've already established that, you know, Ruth makes a lot of bad decisions and is not truthful with Jane and hides a lot of things from her daughter that she probably should not be hiding. But she also, they love each other very much. And I think that's true of a lot of mother-daughter relationships.
Well, thank you so much for that. I think we hit all our major points for the plot within the book. And now we can move on to the Gothameter. So again, we like to rank our books based on their gothiciness, and we have 5 categories. And again, you are welcome to participate and give your own book a rating as well in these categories. So the first category is atmosphere and setting. Jess, what did you mark it as?
Unabashedly, I give it a 10. Because I never didn't, that feeling of creepiness never left me while I was reading this book. The memories, you know, to think back in California and you kind of feel the warmth. But I felt like there is a shadow and a dark cloud. North Manor, classic gothic, you know, creaky house. What's in the corner? We don't know. We don't go into this room. Something bad happened. The rose bush is out there and the roses are turning colors. I give it a 10. How about you, Miss Amy?
I gave it a 9 for all of those reasons. The only reason it got a 9 was because, again, we do get a little bit of reprieve when she's at school and at the cafe and the general town. So we have a taste of what life could have been if there wasn't the dark cloud of North Manor. But yeah, definitely a 9. So, Katrina, how would you rank Horrid in this category?
Oh my gosh, a lot of pressure. But I feel like I'll give it an 8, because I do think you get reprieves, but hopefully they're like purposeful reprieves where you feel like you can take a breath, but then as soon as you do, you're like right back in the gothic, you know, horror of it all.
So category number 2, the past. Jess, what did you think?
Well, I'm going to show my hand here. I'm going to give it a 10 because there is Greer is the memories of her father. That's in the past. On a lighter note, but then North Manor, there's this, again, overhanging darkness that it's just kind of in the air. It's intangible until we kind of discover what secrets it has and what secrets Ruth is keeping from Jane. So I give it a 10. Amy and I differ usually in this category. Did we again?
No, I gave it a 10 too, because there's so many elements of past with her father passing away, the past of Jemima Rose, past of Annie in relation to Jemima Rose, her mom, and all of those things. So yeah, I give it a 10. Katrina, what do you think?
Well, I don't want to break the streak, so I will also give it a 10.
Perfect.
So category number 3, the supernatural. Jess, what did you think?
I'm going to give it a 10. I'm sorry, I'm laughing at myself because I usually, there was a ghost in it. I love a ghost. And just the little weird things. I kept trying to figure out logically how they would happen. And I couldn't get it. And usually, you know, there's a book that Amy and I read called The 13th Tale. It's a great book. And I just could not figure that out. But there was like a logical explanation for a lot of that. The thing that we haven't mentioned that creeped me out the most were the messages to Sal, kind of my nightmare. I always worry that I'm accidentally going to text like Amy something that I was going to text my husband, or, you know, some weirdness was going to happen, or just bullshit, or, you know, to somebody. Mm-hmm. So that couldn't be explained. There was no way Ruth was in there doing any of that. So that was a long-winded way of saying it. I'm giving it a 10.
Yeah, so I'm giving it an 8 for all of those reasons, only marking it down a little again because it is left in the sort of ambiguous of is it psychosis or genuine supernatural. So for that, I'll give it an 8. Katrina, what do you think?
Well, I'm going to give it a 5, middle of the road, because I feel like you could make a compelling argument as the reader for totally supernatural or totally not supernatural.
Mm-hmm. This is true. Alrighty then. So yeah, interesting. So, and then category 4, heroes, heroines, and villains. What did you think, Jess?
Well, first of all, I hope somebody else was writing their score down because I forgot to write everybody's down. I'm giving it a 10 because I felt like every character was a person that I either know, could know, or had, you know, traits of somebody that was flesh and blood. We talk a lot about in Gothic literature, one-dimensional characters, and none of these characters were one-dimensional. I think at different points in my life, I've been Jane, you know, just kind of the roiling anger. I've had good friends. I could remember a Will in my life, just a supportive friend that, you know, whatever. So I liked all these characters. Except when they were horrid. I didn't like when they were nasty. But, you know, up until a point, I really liked everybody and would like to talk to them. So 10. How about you, Miss Amy?
I gave it an 8 for all of those reasons. And again, just you know, what you rightly said it, like a lot of people, especially old school 18th century Gothic literature, was all about like the plot and the crazy supernatural rather than truly fleshing out the characters. But these were very much fleshed out. And even though I still put Jemima Rose in the strong, stark villain category, but at the same time, you can understand why she feels the way she feels, which that is the best type of villain where you don't agree with their choices and the dark path they turn, but you totally get how maybe they possibly were the victim in the first place and how that skewed their way of thinking. Yeah, so for all those reasons, I give it an 8. What about you, Katrina?
I'll give it an 8, too. I feel like I like your point about the characters kind of, there. You know, there's a question there of, like, are they 100% a villain or are they just completely misunderstood and sort of the victim of circumstance.
Mm-hmm. Right. And then finally, category number 5, mystery. Jess?
I'm going to finish this off, and it's not just because I want to do easy math. I'm going to say 10 for mystery. You had me the whole time, and then I didn't know what was going on. And I think that that is a good element that I'm stumbling over my words. Basically, throughout the whole story, I kept thinking this can go one way or this could go this other way. And it just, I was constantly, you know, running through the pages. This is a book that I kept just kind of trying to find excuses to read. And I know there's a good mystery element when I'm doing that, because it's just like, I'm very much a person that's like, no, I got to figure this out. I got to figure this out, to the point where I'll probably, you know, miss some points. So I'm giving it a 10. How about you?
I am giving it a 10 as well. And Katrina, I tend to judge the mystery category significantly more harshly than Jess does, because I read so much mystery and I ding books very much if there's an info dump. But it didn't have any of those shortcomings, the mystery was perfectly well balanced with little pieces and clues slowly accumulating together. And even though the climax of the book at the ending scene was quite dramatic and sudden, I didn't feel like the info that was revealed that it was like dumped on us because Melanie had been like built up a little bit to sort of understand, like, you know, her older sister like institutionalized and has killed herself and like all of those things. So yeah, all those reasons, I gave it a 10. So what about you, Katrina?
Thank you both. Thank you both. And again, I can't be the one to break our streak. So I will also give it a 10.
Awesome. And so I tallied up all our scores. Katrina, you ranked it 41 out of 50. I ranked it 45 out of 50. And for the first time in Sublimely Gothic history, we have someone ranking Horrid at 50 out of 50. Jess.
Hit on all the gothic. You hit on all the things I want to read. We've read other contemporary gothic books that take a turn, and it's just, I'm not on the podcast, not, you know, as individuals. Mm-hmm. We're going to talk more on season 3 about some of those. Yeah, I this was everything I wanted to read in this type of book. So, like I said, I was super psyched to talk to you. So 50, yeah, well, yay!
Thank you so much. I'm honored to be the first 50.
Yay, yes. First 50. Yeah, so let's see. Our last exercise is, you know, our random rereading. Katrina, do you have a copy of Horrid present currently?
I do, yeah.
Would you be so great as to just totally flip through the pages and pick a passage at random, and you can just, like, again, read a paragraph or two or just stop whenever you feel comfortable?
Yes. Randomly picking a page. Ruth was at the kitchen table looking over some paperwork. I thought this was supposed to be a part-time job, Jane said. Ruth jumped a little and looked up, her hand over her chest. Jesus, I didn't even hear you come in. Her mother held out her arms and Jane walked into them. I know I didn't expect to be bringing this much work home. There's just so much to do. How was your day? I feel like that's a good example of what we were talking about how they have just like a nice relationship because, I mean, they're just like hugging for no reason. Like Jane has just got back from, you know, school and Ruth is just doing some paperwork and they like hug when they see each other, which I think is nice and exactly what I would have done with my mom at that age.
And then just me hearing that passage again, it makes me think about, again, it hasn't yet been revealed to Jane all the ways that Ruth is concealing things from her. But we can see looking back that Helen is really trying to occupy her time and again, just is really not wanting to be back in this house and all the bad memories. So she's trying to come up with all sorts of external activities to distract herself from the reality. And then when Jane does discover the truth, that just becomes more so where she's barely in the house.
Yeah, yeah, totally.
And I think you hit on I think that little passage was a great example of the bumps in the night because, you know, she's jarred. I'm a particularly jumpy person, so it doesn't take much, but those little subtleties kind of helped add to the atmosphere of kind of impending doom.
Nice. Alrighty then, and that concludes the first episode of season 3 of Sublimely Gothic. Thank you so much for joining us, Katrina. It was a true delight to have you.
Yeah, thank you both so much for reading Horrid and inviting me on. It was really fun.
And tune in next time, guys. We will be going over The Picture of Dorian Gray by Oscar Wilde. This is one of my dad's favorites in the literature. I don't know why, but I'm going to find out.
Well, I opened that, and I was so glad you said that. The first line, the studio was filled with the rich odor of roses. What a great quote to get.
That's the first line of the book?
Chapter 1. Yeah, I clicked over.
That's incredible.
Wow, nice. Alrighty then, so check out Picture of Dorian Gray with us in 2 weeks. Catch you guys later. Bye.
Bye.